Okay, everyone, I think we'll get going. So you guys can get some lunch and then start heading home. So thank you for staying till the very end for this workshop on mental health, this one specifically on depression and HIV. So I hope that you brought some cases with you or some thoughts and we can have some discussion. I have a very few slides just to kick things off while I was thinking about how to approach this workshop and how the whole issue of depression and HIV affects me in my practice. So I'm in the University of Nebraska and I direct the HIV program there, and we have about 1,200 patients and funding from Ryan White's parts C and D, and then of course B for the ADAP. So been doing that for a while. I had to give the disclosures. I have made some objectives, really just about, I think the tricky parts are diagnosis and then, of course, treatment. So you, all of you in HIV care, you know this is a common problem. We see it a lot. This is a slide I got from a friend who's Glenn Treisman, who's a psychiatrist at Hopkins and has presented at this conference before. I don't know if you've, any of you have heard him, but highly entertaining and lovely man. And so he came up with this idea of this kind of vicious cycle of things that can go wrong when people get diagnosed with HIV, because they already have, I can't even really read it from here, but, you know, stress and sometimes substance abuse issues and everything in their lives, and then they get HIV in part because of some of these problems that they've had, and it just becomes this vicious cycle. And of course, once they get diagnosed, that really pulls the rug out from under them and makes things 10 times worse. And so he reckons about 20% of our patients have depression. Does that make sense to you guys? You think about 1 in 5? I see some nodding. Yeah,
more than
you think? More?
Yeah.
Okay. And, of course, like as I said, worse with new diagnosis, but often under-recognized and under-treated and complicated by the other things that we've talked about, you know, cognitive impairment and that goes with HIV. And sometimes we see in newly diagnosed patients and then substance abuse issues that kind of muddy the water. So in terms of diagnosis, sometimes it's obvious. This is Eeyore, you know, from Winnie the Pooh, and it only rains on him. But, you know, this is where you walk in the exam room and you feel depressed. You know, it's just sort of somehow in the air, and it's just radiating out of this person, and they're just so sad and helpless, and you can't hardly get them to look at you, you know, let alone smile. And so I think for those cases, it's relatively clear what you're dealing with, and the biggest issue is trying to get them to get on board with it and maybe talk about some treatment strategies. But then there are some others that you know, you don't necessarily engage with, but you're not quite sure what it is. You know, are they don't like going to the doctor, they're just unhappy they have HIV, there may be some other sort of cultural things. It's just sometimes a little bit harder to get at what's going on. And so there's obviously all kinds of tools you can use and screening tests and what have you, but I just brought this one to illustrate it, because this is one that I actually use because it's like really short. It's like 2 questions and the scoring is like really easy. And so you can ask it in a variety of ways about, you know, how much fun people have in their lives, what gives them pleasure, and sometimes people will have nothing to say. You know, they've got nothing to offer about, well, I enjoy X, or, you know, I go to a movie with my friends or something. And then you can, of course, just ask them if they're feeling down and depressed. But some people will deny that, and they'll say, no, I'm fine. But and then you can just score it very simply, and then get the scoring thing didn't quite transmit terribly well, but it's easy to find this PHQ-2, and then the probability of either major depression or any kind of depressive disease is illustrated there, that you can use to guide your treatment, or even share with the patient and say, look, you know, based on this, you might be suffering from depression. You know, how do you feel about that we tried to address that. So I don't know if any of you guys use other sorts of tools like this, or does anyone have other?
We use the PHQ 9.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
We screened everybody with two.
Uh-huh.
If they hit the 3 or above, then it reflexes automatically to a 9.
And then do you just give it to them like on a piece of paper and say, fill this out, or you go, is that how you go?
This is electronic.
Okay. Okay.
Hand it out at the time they come in for their appointment.
On paper.
On paper, and if they have one a score above a 5, we do one at the subsequent visits until they're doing well. If they're just scoring below 5, we just do it once a year, you know, in the annual kind of exam.
On everybody.
We do it on everybody.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
We're in a community center where we have to do it on everybody. It's kind of one of those roles. And so there's this like mass push for the MAs to always get the scoring. And for most of my, I'm in a homeless FQHC. So most of my patients do have some kind of illness and are in treatment for that. And it is being addressed. And the push then to the go and get the tool, like smack dab in the middle of everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the push to just do it, and I
just to check the box kind of thing.
I struggle with my administrators over if this is the right thing to do for everyone, because we just are measured by the metric of needing to do it. I mean, we certainly are addressing their mental health, but maybe not with these screening tools.
Yeah.
And someone who's previously diagnosed.
Somebody's being followed, and we keep getting 12, 14, 15.
Yeah, and we're, you know, the MA comes in all a bother, like, oh my gosh, he scored a 6. I'm like, yeah, he's been on treatment for forever, and I've been desperately trying to get him.
Yeah, this is actually better, right?
So, I don't know, I feel like we have these tools, and there's this rush for, like, this should make mental health care easier, and it sometimes gets in the way a little bit. It's a screening tool, it's not a...
It's not a diagnostic
treatment.
Tool.
It's not a diagnostic tool. It's not a treatment, but it's being translated from the institutions as you are not screening enough.
Then you get dinged for it. If this is an FHQ thing and they just say you have to screen everyone.
Yeah.
And so then the MAs always will come and tell you if someone's score is abnormal or does it get missed or just... Because in my clinic, you have to ask some questions, but they just check these boxes. And if I don't think about it to look, it's just, you know, I don't know. It's just there just so we can say we checked the box.
So we have a method that we use at UAB where everybody gets screened. It's electronic, so... When they're doing their signs and symptoms sheet, they do the PHQ-2, and it reflexes to a 9 if it's appropriate. And then if it scores appropriately on the 9, then that goes to the social worker, and the social worker intervenes. And after the social worker intervenes, she or he will come and talk to the provider and say, this is what we discussed today, you know, if you want to put it in your note.
So this is all like before they get in the exam room, right?
That's right.
So you got 40 minutes, you know,
before. Oh, while they're waiting, right.
Okay, all right.
We're fortunate enough that we have mental health counselors and a psychiatrist in our office.
Yeah, that's great. I think that's ideal, really.
Our mental health counselors on the PHQ-9 go over it with them, and then if they're going to a psychiatrist as needed, but we're fortunate enough to have this.
Yeah, no, that's ideal if you can have that. Well, it'd be no point, really, if they're seeing a psychiatrist, right?
Right. So unless that psychiatrist says I need a PHQ-9, we don't repeat that annually if we're seeing a psychiatrist.
Well, the PHQ-9 picks up suicidality, I think. And so, I mean, that's the rationale that we use, regardless of whether they're in care with the psychiatrist or not. If the patient's in the clinic today and the patient's expressing thoughts of suicidality, you know, we try to intervene then. Not simply because they're engaged with the psychiatrist. I mean, that's the method that we use.
Yep.
Well, I'm from a rural setting, so to speak. It's the county's north of Dallas, but they're very rural. And So we don't have psychiatrists on site. And in fact, we have a very limited number of psychiatry referrals we can make. And so I treat a lot of simple depression myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think probably we all do, right? I mean, kind of have to, because like you say, there's a limited number, or there's long waiting lists. You know, they get an appointment like 3 months away. Well, what's the point of that, really, to be honest? So, yeah. Yeah. Yes, hello.
But then at the same time, we were warned by the psychiatrist that the person is bipolar. You know,
yes.
You can't start them on a regular antidepressant.
So it makes it worse, right?
Right. So, you know, we have been kind of walking, you know, that fine line. And, you know, they tell us they're depressed, but then 2 visits later, they'll say, oh, I forgot to tell you I was diagnosed with bipolar. And so, so you know, we've kind of sort of become kind of gun-shy.
Sure.
About doing the medication, just a simple SSRI.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. Personally, I've seen it rarely, but it's dramatic when it happens. If you, you know, give someone an SSRI that really is bipolar, they can go completely bonkers. And, it goes badly. I don't know what the data are, frankly, but I think it's relatively rare, but it is something that you do have to be careful of. Yes, it's very popular.
There's kind of been some pushback in my clinic that it's often like misdiagnosed with PTSD. And so, in consultation with our behavioral health people, we sometimes will try an SSRI with some kind of skepticism.
Yes. Oh, I completely agree. I think it's become very fashionable now. Everybody wants to be, somehow being depressed is just, I don't know, a stigma or something, but being bipolar is, It is. And I don't know, I could be completely off track here and stereotyping, but a lot of my gay men patients, you know, fancy themselves as bipolar, and they, you know, tell me about how they couldn't take their medicine this month because their bipolarism kicked in and it's just been terrible. But, you know, we all have mood swings, obviously, and some people have more exaggerated ones, and quite where you draw the line, I don't know. But I kind of agree with you. It seems like very much overdiagnosed, really. Cause... Sure. Yes. Many things can do that, but... In a true bipolar disorder, then you do have to be careful. But they're, I think, maybe less common than the data would suggest. Yeah, you're the Miami lady, right?
Yeah, I have a lot of older women, and so my problem comes dysthymia, menopause, because it's all this sleep disorder that I'm dealing with.
Can't sleep.
Falling asleep or waking up early in the morning.
How do you approach it?
Well, I try the trazodone to help me fall asleep. And then all the behavioral stuff that she doesn't sleep
for. All the sleep hygiene stuff? Yeah. It's kind of like diet and exercise, right? Sounds good, but...
I get a full major depression diagnosis with referral, but they never go. So then we try an SSRI, which they never quite take. So it's like...
Do you?
That have specifically sleep problems. But I mean, there's some other qualifications for that. But if they don't have any anxiety issues along with it, and you know, because it can cause some weight gain too, so I don't use it if they're obese. But I find that helps some in initiating and helping them.
Just like at a low dose or
a
regular dose?
I usually start at a low dose and kind of reassess them 4 to 6 weeks or so and see how they're doing on it. But I mean, I feel like it helps a lot of people in that sense because it does help.
Yes, people can sleep well. That helps a lot. Okay.
It's cheap. It's real cheap. You know,
generic.
It's a $4.
So then the next thought I had was about if you do consider a patient newly diagnosed with depression, you know, how do you deal with that? And we've already talked a lot about this, you know, the referral process and some of the problems inherent with that. We can talk some more about the medicines, but I think that one thing that sometimes gets overlooked in my experience is this so-called contract with the patient, you know, not to kill themselves. Now, of course, it's not really a contract because it isn't, you know, they don't necessarily sign anything, but just to have that one-on-one conversation where you kind of look them in the eye and, you know, ask them about how they feel about suicide, they had thoughts, they have plans, they have a gun in the house, blah, 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 and then to ask them to please, you know, contact someone from the clinic or give them some kind of option of what to do if it gets really serious. And I think that's often just not done. I don't know if what your experience is too. Somehow it's just, it's a difficult conversation to have, obviously. And you have to kind of follow up by being available when they call you at some inconvenient time saying, you know, I'm feeling worse or what have you. But I do feel that's a important piece of it. So just see some nodding. Anyone else, other thoughts about that? Or okay.
Our social, again, you know, our social workers, having a social worker in the clinic and available, you know, they have those resources and they generally have the time to have that contract, to document the contract in the chart. I mean, it's really proven to be very helpful for us.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've had patients tell me later, you know, and if the ones that come out the other end of it, you know, that they did appreciate that and that that was something that, you know, obviously is on their mind all the time, but they don't know how to talk about it to their friends or their family. And so they're kind of glad to have the opportunity quite often.
I had a patient who recently tried to hang himself. And he failed in the attempt, and he had previously tried to kill himself. And so, you know, just the whole issue of have they ever done anything like that before really heightens the potential that they'll do it again. You know,
yeah.
If they've had a failed attempt in the past, those people really come high to the level. And we've actually transported several patients to the hospital who we felt were really unsafe to go
to let
home.
Them go home,
right.
Have them go to the ER. And
right.
Yeah.
I'm in a situation where I don't have a lot of mental health counselors, and the psychiatrist is on part-time, and so then I'm left being the provider and the mental health counselor and the primary care provider.
Yep.
And, you know, they're sitting there with blood sugars like 450, blood pressure 202 over, I don't know, 102, and then they're crying, and then it's like, so that's the dilemma.
Totally. So, I mean, one thing you didn't really highlight was being their HIV doctor, because in many ways that's the easy part now, right? You know, we've got all these drugs that work really well, and they're just once a day. You've got to try to get people to just take it every day. But it's all this other issues, and some of it is just lack of availability of consultants you can refer to easily. And I don't know if you're doing this through your Ryan White program, so then, you know, you can't reimburse them very much, right, often. So then they, you know, for example, in our area, for some reason we can't get dentists to agree to what we can pay them. You know, they won't take Medicaid and they want to, anyway. So, I mean, I'm sympathetic, but that's, but it's difficult. And then patients don't want to go anywhere else. You know, they want you to do it because they don't trust other doctors and they're just more comfortable in the place, their sort of medical home, and so they want you to do all of it. And I completely agree with you. And I honestly, I've always said being an HIV doctor is great because you're always learning something new. But, you know, going back to having to learn to treat hypertension and diabetes, I can't say I love that. I really, it's just, I don't know about the rest of you. It's just I didn't really want to be doing that, right?
Right.
And trying to keep up with it. Okay.
So it's really just being able to, well, can't you just write, I was on Seroquel, I can't remember the dosage.
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, I'm not going to,
Yes. Yeah, I'd be interested in getting a poll from the room on that, because that comes out all the time. And sometimes they're on stuff I'm not familiar with, some of these new atypical antipsychotics. You know, it's like, what even is that? And they want you to just refill it for them, and you don't know how to monitor it or what to look for. Or yeah.
I mean, I think that's part of the problem, because I'm a primary care, and there's just not a lot of psychiatric services.
Yeah.
I mean, I try to treat depression, and I find myself treating a lot of bipolar disorder as well, because I have to, because nobody else is going to do it. But I don't... I'm not familiar with antipsychotics, so I don't use those. But I get to the point where I've tried several different medications, or tried for depression, tried several different antidepressants, and they're not improving, and I'm like, I don't know what to do next. And I think that's where the problem comes in, is that I can only do so much in my training, and I don't know where to go beyond that.
Yeah.
And it would be a really great thing if HRSA could, like, to have these prep lines and these hotlines and all of that kind of stuff for HIV. It would be great if HRSA and SAMHSA would come together and develop a prep line or a hotline for mental health problems
for us
to be able to call and run cases by them and give us, you know, recommendations.
Exactly. And even when we get them to the psychiatric experts, still there could be things like starting somebody on Ritalin, on Trilepto or oxycodone, you know, that decreases the Ritalin levels. So even the experts on their side have some difficulties
with the drug interactions. Oh, completely. And in my experience, they seem completely oblivious. They don't give it any thought. Someone's on a, you know, a booster, it just kind of slides right by. I don't know. And then you call them and they're like, oh, okay, you know. So, but we've had people in the hospital over some of these, you know, with these, some of these newer drugs. But yeah, I don't know how to get them to focus on that, but they doesn't seem to happen. So, and you know, and somehow if it's a different doctor, they might go to a different pharmacy. So then you miss the opportunity there, where at least the pharmacist might catch it. Although they often miss it too, I'm sure you're all aware.
You know, Laura Cheever told us this week that they now have a new director of SAMHSA. So this might be an opportunity to approach SAMHSA about doing something like this.
Yeah. If they have the resources, yeah.
We're looking at telepsychiatry.
Yeah, that's kind of a in thing, isn't it, too? How's that working out?
We're just going to look at it right now.
Okay.
We haven't incorporated it yet, but we're trying to get patient-centered medical home status, and that's one of the things we need to incorporate better referrals.
Yeah. Has anyone had experience with that, just parenthetically? Yeah. But does it work well when she can do it? I mean, because we've had all kinds of technical problems with it, and just if the system actually works.
No, it seems to.
She has a regular schedule.
Yes, please.
We have a scheduler for ours. We have five different sites that the site nurse practitioner works with. And so we did have to centralize a scheduling system, and that has helped. Just an MA who's responsible for that. And we've actually done one post-patient survey, just because we think it's a great idea.
Yeah.
The patient, like, looking at a screen and divulging everything about themselves, and it actually was very favorable.
Huh.
So it has prompted us to continue it rather than keep our search for an in-person site, because it is quite cost-effective.
Yeah, and the patients liked it.
They didn't seem to mind it, yeah.
Hmm. Okay. You were going to say something, yes.
I was just going to say, I think my office, we just died and went to heaven. We have a psychiatrist that comes 3 days a month. He has an MA that does the scheduling, and she overbooks them to the max because she knows how many of the patients are going to no-show. He's really good about doing phone sessions with patients when he's there, because he knows they may not come in. Our social workers handle the PHQs that are anything that are suicidal, or we do the PHQ-9s. And then we've contracted with several therapists who will accept what we will pay them to see our patients who don't have insurance, or who won't see a therapist privately. So we still have a lot of patients that have the depression and we're dealing with it. But I mean, we have a lot of things lined up that are really not ideal for our people.
Where are you?
Where? Allegheny General in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Our clinic actually was started by a nurse and a nurse practitioner. That was where we got our funding. And I think the nurse practitioner just looked at the whole clinic and how to deliver care more from her viewpoint than from a provider's viewpoint. And as a result, a lot of things got lined up very early in our clinic. Sorry to end.
No, I know. Well, in our clinic, we actually have... We could fund a psychiatrist to come, you know, like we say, 3 days a month or something, just finding someone who's willing to do. Yeah, yeah, and they're all too busy, and so, you know, it's just...
They don't always get it either. They don't always get the harm reduction thing.
Yes.
Usually in psychiatry, it's much more black and white.
Black and white, yes, you mustn't, yes, just say no, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sending them out the door,
yes.
So that the overworked counselor can see them, but then yet she's backed up until November.
Yeah.
And the overworked provider has to check those drug interactions.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. But I hear that a lot from patients too when they finally do get to see a psychiatrist. It's just, well, he just gives, yeah, exactly. He just gave me a prescription and that was it.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe that's all they got time for, I don't know, but. Yeah, somebody at the back wants to say something. Yes.
The other thing I thought of as you were sharing is the telepsych is available for consultation to us in primary care and HIV, and that's been really helpful. So if someone comes in on a bipolar mood stabilizer and I'm like, I don't know if this is the right dose or how to adjust, I can call him and he can give me guidance where maybe I can bypass the wait time for the patient to see him and I can continue or titrate or something. So that's also a really nice feature is that
well, that's what Jim was talking about for this sort of maybe national hotline, right? That would be an ideal use for that if we could get something like that going.
I think comfort with prescribing it yourself because I've only started doing HIV care August 1. We just got Ryan White.
This Friday, August?
But I do primate.
Like 3 weeks ago?
We're a community health system. But I've been in family practice for 8 years.
Uh-huh.
So when I was talking about the telehealth, it was all of our patients in this community health center system, not HIV patients.
Uh-huh.
So they'll be able to use it too. But I am co-located where the psychiatric nurse practitioner is, and I can, you know, she's one office down, so I can pop in and ask her a question at any time. So I think that probably gives me a little more comfort with prescribing mood stabilizers to bipolars and not giving them SSRIs or anything that would trigger mania. And I will even do a little bit of Haldol if someone has a history of psychosis until they can get to see her. So there's just a comfort level with having worked beside her for 8 years that if we had some kind of consult, something at 800 number we could call, everybody could develop that comfort to manage some of that. And I mean, I see a lot of depression. It's community health center population, but more anxiety.
Yes. Really. Yes. Yes. So by a general poll, how do we feel about that? You happy giving people Xanax? Everybody wants Xanax, but
no.
Oh, that's so funny. I know it's just exactly how I feel. It's like, no. No OxyContin, no Xanax, right?
I have people coming in to me and they've been on Xanax for
years. Well, that's a problem. Yes. Yes.
I mean, how do you get off of it?
Yeah. Oh, it's terrible. It's just terrible. Well, most of them don't even want to. It's like, oh, no, you can't take away my Xanax. You know, it's like the sky would fall. So, I'm completely with you.
Anxiety can be a symptom of depression. So
sure.
You know, if they present to you, exploring that possibility.
I mean, and obviously there's other ways to try to treat anxiety, although I can't say I find them spectacularly useful, you know, to buspirone and that kind of stuff. People don't love that or find it awfully helpful, a little bit maybe, but
I mean, if you got diagnosed with diagnosed with HIV, wouldn't you be anxious?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, it's incredibly stressful. Yeah. Well, but, you know, it's the American way of things. It's like you have to have a pill for being sad or anxious or, you know, it's people still want that, I think, want to feel better. You know, just take grief for an example. I mean, how many times have you had patients want medicine because they can't sleep well because somebody died? You know, well, it's like you say, it's normal and natural, but anyway. Yeah. 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 Yeah, so I don't know if this transmits very well. I saw someone try and take a picture of it, but I don't know. I sent it to the organizers. This is like an online syllabus or something you can look at, so it should be there. Or if you want to email me, our pharmacist actually made us this. So how many of you guys have a pharmacist? No? Not even half. Okay. Because that is a wonderful thing, I have to say. Having an HIV pharmacist in the clinic is just terrific. Having a psychiatrist too would be nice, but having him. So this I find helpful just as a sort of a quick look. And then, of course, the most important part is the interactions. And so I've taken a sort of a bit of an easy way out here, but I just give everybody, pretty much everybody, this, which, because it's easy. So this is like Lexapro, escitalopram. And it has some issues with sexual dysfunction, but they all do, but not really with the weight gain, and a very low risk of significant drug interactions with anything that you can use. So that's really why I like it. And if you look at the psychiatric literature, there's very little proper, what I would consider, randomized controlled trials of head-to-head comparisons of a lot of these drugs. In fact, a lot of psychiatric literature is really not terribly good quality in terms of evidence to base guidelines on. But there's really not a lot that helps you choose between all of these drugs. And so, not that I'm advertising it particularly, but that's why I just have kind of picked one that I'm relatively familiar with, and I don't have to worry about the interactions.
Lexapro has gone generic yet?
Yes.
It
has. Yeah, so it's very cheap, okay, too. Yes, I forgot. I should put that in there. Do you? No, I can't send people to Walmart. It's just such a terrible place. Yeah, so a lot of them do. A lot of grocery stores do. But yeah. Sometimes it's the only option. I do understand, but it's just... And then I think the next slide is about some of the more atypical drugs, you know, and some of these newer ones that we're seeing that, again, will have varying degrees of risk of drug interaction. And is there maybe one more? Oh, no, that might be it. Oh, yeah. So I did want to talk about this a bit, because this comes up in my clinic a lot, and many of you have probably seen these data on risk of suicidality with efavirenz. And so this was based on, started with, post-marketing case reports and what have you, and then was actually looked at in a large randomized clinical trial that wasn't looking at this particularly. It was a post hoc, investigation after the fact, looking at people that were randomized to different antiviral regimens with or without efavirenz, and what was the issue with suicide. So the absolute risk is still very small. It wasn't just everyone was committing suicide, but there was definitely a significant difference between patients that were on efavirenz-containing regimens and those that weren't. And then contradicting that is some retrospective, as they call it, real-world data showing really very little. But I'm much more persuaded by the randomized clinical trial data. And so I get asked a lot, you know, we have all these patients who have been on efavirenz, 10, 15 years now? And if they're depressed, you know, should we switch them? So I'd just be interested in opinions from the room about what you guys are doing or how you feel about that.
Anybody who has anxiety off of it.
Even, and then if they tell you they have sleep trouble, you move, you switch them for that?
Well, it depends on if they're, you know, 400 pounds and...
Yeah, have sleep apnea. Yeah, 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 yeah.
But I would do it for sleep problems.
Yeah, because that's a common thing. And I just, I wonder, you know, based on the data about the sleep disturbance and the abnormal dreams from... The clinical trials, it, for the most part, was relatively short-lived. And so we're talking about 10 years later. Is it really going to make a difference? And then, you know, whenever you switch, there's always a risk of something going wrong. They get a side effect from the new drug or they somehow lose virologic control. You know, those things can go wrong. So this is, I think, a kind of tricky one, to be honest.
But, you know, it's interesting that the patients that I've taken off a triple... So many times they come back to me later and say, I didn't realize, you know, how I actually felt. You know, they
yeah.
feel so much better. A lot of them come back and say, I just feel so much better.
I agree with that.
Yeah, everyone's had that experience. Yeah, I mean, I've been doing it more so now, like trying to get people off tenofovir, you know, as they get older and their kidneys start to go down the toilet, as it were, and you know, you want to get them off that and so get them on something a bit more modern. And I've had the same reaction. People come in just generally feeling better and just so happy to be on something they don't have to take at bedtime and doesn't interfere with it. So maybe the sleep disturbance is longer lasting than we thought.
It's the brain fog, as they call it.
Yes. The fog lifts.
Yeah.
And so I think I also had a slide of something that may or may not be as familiar. And so this is the data on rilpivirine are actually not far off, and it's not one of my favorite drugs, to be honest, but that also has about the same incidence of suicidal ideation or attempted suicide. And there's emerging data now, mostly post-marketing reports of depression and suicidal ideation with patients on integrase regimens. And that's something that, you know, we're really pretty much starting everybody on now. So these are a couple of series of case reports. And I'm actually on the with Jim on the antiretroviral HHS treatment guidelines, and this is going to be in the next iteration later this year about being careful about people with pre-existing depression and mental health disorders. And quite what we do with this, I don't know, because the integrases have so many, you know, other advantages and are kind of the go-to regimen now, but it is something to think about. Yes, well, and we don't know yet about cabotegravir as an integrase. That's the other once-monthly regimen that's the injection that's being looked at. And so there's in the clinical trials, there's been like maybe 200 out of the several hundred people that have been part of these studies that have reported anything like this. But we're actually doing those trials at my site, those injection studies, and they... Every time people come in, we have to do this suicidality screening thing. It's called the Columbia Suicidality Score or something. It's quite a long, complicated screening thing with every single visit. So they're looking for it, but it is just something to kind of keep in the back of your mind. If you have someone who's pretty depressed to begin with and you start them on an integrase-based regimen, maybe, you know, keep an eye on the depressive symptoms and make sure that that doesn't get out of hand, because there are some data suggesting that even though it's relatively rare, that these regimens can contribute to that too. Mechanism is completely unknown, but it just seems to happen. So,
you know, with the injectables, we're doing that at UAB too, and I get a fair number of negative suicidalities. You know, they bring the, you know, once they screen in, then they have to be evaluated further. And so as the investigator, you know, I have to sign off on those that they were investigated and it was a negative suicidality. So,
mm-hmm.
So it just seems like it's real important to do the screening, but sometimes the instruments are a little overly sensitive.
Oh, I think so. Yeah. I mean, because this Columbia thing, you know, asks people about, have you ever once even had a fleeting thought about, you know, killing yourself? Well, I mean, almost everybody has occasionally. And so, you know, it's just, like you say, it's very sensitive to almost, you know, stuff that happens to people in their adolescence and what have you, and it's like 15 years ago and probably completely irrelevant, but anyway, just something something else to kind of be aware of with these nice new regimens that we have that are so good in many ways, but maybe just something else to think about. Yes. Sort of passive suicide thing. It's just we want to wake up dead kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I hear that from patients too. So you just listen and...
No, I refer on, but you still want to go.
Yeah. Yeah, and some people just decide that's how life is, I think, right? They just kind of get resigned to it and so don't necessarily want to go see someone and talk about it and take some medicine. One of the things that I thought, I love the guy that talked about the opioid thing, but one of the things I thought was interesting that I hadn't really thought about is if you have a patient who doesn't want to change their behavior for whatever reason, to recruit their family members. And that's not something I've ever done without the patient there. I don't know if any of you guys have ever tried that or...
Well, you have to get permission.
Sure, sure, yeah. Well, assuming the patient gives you permission. I mean, occasionally, you know, family members will want an appointment to come talk to us about, you know, their concerns about somebody, but I don't know that I've ever... actively kind of recruited. He said siblings are the best, right, for some sort of interesting reasons. People to come in and help deal with a patient that's just not willing to work with us.
I find I use it more in men if they have significant others and they're willing to share. I'll tell them bring their spouse or partner. Because if men, if I don't get the partner to help with the drugs, they just seem to forget. The women, I don't have as much trouble.
The antiretroviral drugs, you mean?
Yeah.
They need their mother to tell them to take their medicine kind of thing. Yeah. Yes. That's a big one. Yes. Yes. Do you think it's more than that, though? Don't you think it's just...
I do, but I'm asking them to explain to me. And several of them will stop it there. Although it made them feel good temporarily, engaging in sex is more important to them.
Well, I think it's, you know, particularly if you're depressed and feeling kind of generally worthless and then you can't even get an erection, it's somehow just another thing to... you know, feel bad about, but it is, it's an issue, and of course there are, you know, some evidence that our male patients may have more problem with erectile dysfunction than their peers, you know, that don't have HIV. I have never seen anything persuasive that the anti-HIV drugs that we use contribute to this, but certainly... the antidepressants can certainly do that. And so that's a theme that comes up very often in our clinic, I'm sure.
I think
of those two. It's like I'm sometimes never cease to be amazed by patients coming in and they got all kinds of problems. You know, the HIV is out of control, or maybe they got Hep C or some other kind of opportunistic disease, and the only thing they care about is that they can't get an erection. That's the only thing sort of on the agenda. It's just like they really want that dealt with, and then the rest of it, you know.
That's daily and primary care. They don't come into the routine and stops working. No, that's controlled by a That's my bread and butter in primary care.
So
when you said a lot, I do a lot of encouraging the Viagra if they can afford it, because then they'll use more condoms, because that erectile dysfunction is real.
Oh, for sure. No, I'm not. I mean, I'm being facetious, but no, it is an absolute real thing. So do you do that even if people have undetectable viremia? You're still saying you want them to use a condom all the time? This is a whole different topic, but it's kind of interesting.
Now that the data is more consistent with it, in the beginning, as it was now,
uh-huh.
Definitely undetected is probably on.
No, definitely.
Maybe a little bit less, but they still like the erections. So it makes them happier and they come to their business.
If you tell them you're not going to give them or you're not going to prescribe a PDE5 inhibitor, I mean, the chances of them continuing to come back to you is pretty low.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you, any of you guys have conditions for that? Like, you know, I'll give you this, but what's the but?
I need to see that you're picking up. I need to see appearance on your antiretrovirals. Your viral load needs to be suppressed.
Uh-huh. So what happens when they show up next time with gonorrhea? Then what do you do?
We're not able to do those right now because we need to go back to the drawing board and do some more education and some treatment.
Because that's what's happening in our clinic. You know, everyone's getting gonorrhea and chlamydia and syphilis. So then how do you handle that if you're giving them a drug for erectile dysfunction?
They can be prosecuted for transmitting HIV in our state.
Where do you live? Interesting.
I had a patient that was picked up for under the law, criminal law, because
prosecuted for transmitted HIV, and then
considered as a weapon.
Convicted and imprisoned and all that.
Let's see, wow, yeah.
Hmm.
Met a woman online.
Didn't seem to change behavior, though, does it?
No, where do they think that somebody report him, or was it the STI clinic?
He actually confessed to that. That's what he was doing. So, you know, he's been seen as a weapon.
I don't know. Yeah. It's hard to know how valuable that kind of behavior is. Yes, you haven't said much, but yeah.
So, my clinic in rural Connecticut, it's a chance for our patients. We have samples of Cialis.
Yes.
We have a very highly Latino population.
Uh-huh.
And so they come in and they don't want to admit for stigma what it's for and all that stuff, but they'll find different names for it, but we attach it to. So I have medical case managers there Monday through Friday, 8 to 5. So they have to see one of them and have an appointment and get, you know, meeting with them to be able to get the Cialis. They can't just get it and it's not attached to, you know, but. My medical case managers work very closely with the ID doctor who sees them. You know,
so they don't have to have undetectable virus to begin with or anything?
Well,
or?
It's up to the doctor, and he says, you know, I'm okay with this person coming in. And they are very closely talking to him through text if he's not in clinic. He's only in clinic 2 afternoons a week, but constantly saying, you know, so-and-so is coming in, they have an appointment for us, they want the Cialis, is it okay to give? And he'll do that. But it's a way for us to keep tabs on them, and they're getting their paperwork done, because we're FQHC, we're Ryan White Senior. tracking that we have to do with them.
Boxes to check, yeah.
It's sort of a little carrot to dangle to be able to get them in so that we're laying eyes on them.
Do you check for testosterone levels first? I mean,
we don't just give it to them. They obviously have an appointment with the doctor.
When it's prescribed, are the erectile dysfunctions being worked up with free testosterone?
Or Jimboia, does anyone, counsel when it comes down to those PIs and Viagra?
Oh, the drug interactions, you mean? Sure, yeah, yeah.
Right. People still doing that based on just kind of, I need to know. I had a patient that asked for Viagra who's on, I think he's on
a booster. Yeah, just give him low dose, just like 5 milligrams.
Okay.
Or 10 milligrams and cut it in half.
They're like, they want it regardless, and I'm just kind of going.
You can give some.
Okay.
Yeah, but.
I give the 20 milligram. Generic Bravatio, and so if they shop that around, the 20 milligram is the perfect the perfect amount, and they can shop that around and usually get the pill for $4 to $6.
What is the name of
it? It's generic Sildenafil.
It's like the generic for Viagra.
The trade name is Bravatio. It was it was created and marketed for. Pulmonary hypertension, but it's the perfect dose.
Okay.
I don't know, is anybody else bothered by someone saying you can only get the sex health or, normal sexual function enabling drug if you do this X, Y, and Z?
It's tough.
I find that a little offensive to me.
I completely understand, but, it's sort of, somebody you mentioned sort of like a carrot? It's a way to at least encourage that. And so.
Most of our patients are extremely below the poverty level. So
yeah.
Because we have samples, they're willing to come in and get them because they can't afford the prescriptions. That's just our population. They have no cars. They're just, it's really difficult for them to do much of anything.
A carrot's fine, but. When it's in a punitive manner, I.
So if you have someone who's not taking their antiretrovirals and they've got, HIV viremia, wouldn't have any qualms about giving them Viagra or some equivalent?
No, I have qualms about giving that medicine anyway if they're on other medications that have drug interactions, but I generally work up the erectile dysfunction and find out if that may be an issue.
Blood pressure and
I certainly would prescribe it if
Viagra.
They were
a hostage until they take their statins and their blood pressure.
That's a different way of doing it.
Primary care, but like I said, I'm 3 weeks into HIV care. I don't know that I would hold it hostage over ART.
But
you got to look at what the problem is. Yeah, what's causing the.
Well, often there's nothing to find, though. You're going to find
it.
Sure, but most of my patients. I've reached the 90% on non-detectable, so we're at, most of my patients aren't this kind of person. I'm not sure what I would do if somebody's going out and having sex without informing their partners and not using condoms.
It's a tough area for sure.
So I will say this: I take care of about 750 patients, and I've had patients who want a PDE5 inhibitor. And I'll just tell them, I said, I play a role in this, and I'm not comfortable prescribing this to you until we get you to undetectable.
That's what I tell them.
Once you achieve undetectable, then we can have this discussion, and I'm sure that we can come
to
some sort of agreement. But I don't hold people hostage, but it's at the same hand, you have to be able to talk with patients and use those carrots and those kind of things to help you,
Yeah, I have very similar conversations with my patients too. So,
I
found it quite successful actually.
Yeah.
So,
but I have flat refused to allow patients. I said I can't write the prescription. I'm not scheduled to come back to see you for 3 months. Well, let's think about it. Maybe we could move that appointment up a little bit. But, you know, I need to see undetectable before we can have this discussion.
Okay. Well, I think our time is up. We've come totally off topic, but great discussion. So thank you all for joining in.